But I want to revisit a controversial subject that we've discussed quite a few times, the NDE, yes, the near-death experience. My guest, Dr. Sam Parnia, believes that these experiences are now reported so routinely, few people who've studied in the field can doubt it's a real phenomenon that warrants further study. But he has a problem with the term near-death experience, preferring to call it an actual death experience because he doesn't think it entirely and accurately reflects the science of what's now being studied. Sam has written one of the first medicine-based studies ever conducted of what happens to the mind and psyche after the heart has stopped. He's currently conducting the world's largest ever study of mind and brain during cardiac arrest, the so-called AWARE study, an initial 3 to 5 year long investigation of patients who claimed to have been aware of being resuscitated. The good Dr. Parnia is a critical care doctor, director of resuscitation research at the Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York. And he's also the founder and director of the Human Consciousness Project at the University of Southampton. Sam's the author of The Lazarus Effect, the science that's erasing the boundaries between life and death. And I welcomed him to our New York studio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
In parenthesis, I'm just curious as to your own religious inclinations before we plough on.
Well, I don't have any religious inclination, and it's important to understand that I come, and people like myself, come from this from the perspective of intensive care medicine. Our goal as intensive care physicians is to ensure that patients who are critically ill do not die and that we can save them. However, whether we like it or not, unfortunately, a proportion of our patients do die and they go beyond the threshold of death. And what's important to understand is that through the advances in resuscitation, particularly in the last 10 years, we're now able to reverse death after it has occurred for a period of not just a couple of minutes, but tens of minutes, if not hours of time, after a person has literally turned into a corpse.
That's a thing that I find so extraordinary, that the time scale has been so extended so quickly.
Absolutely. This is what is fascinating, and this is why I think it's important for people to understand. And part of the reason I wrote the book is to really bring everyone up to the 21st century rather than the 20th century with respect to the subject of resuscitation science, but also what implications it has for our understanding of what happens when we die. And that's essentially what I do.
We'll get onto that a little later, but as you point out, traditionally what doctors have been doing since the 60s, 70s is essentially chest compressions and providing breath to a person, CPR. But now there are other technologies available, which include, of course, automated CPR machines that deliver both breaths and chest compressions.
That's right. It's important to explain, if I may, just take two steps back to explain to the audience what we're really talking about. Most people who are listening, if not everyone, has a perception of what is death. And the perception that we have, by and large, is that there is a moment that you reach, and when you reach that point, you cannot come back, and that is what we consider death. Now, medically, the way that death has been defined and continues to be, you know, if someone gives a time of death in hospitals, it's when the heart stops beating. And as soon as the heart stops beating, for whatever illness that may have caused that, whether it's a gunshot wound or a meningitis or a heart attack or whatever it may be, eventually the heart stops beating. And as a consequence, people stop breathing and then the brain shuts down. And that's why people develop fixed and dilated pupils of the eyes. In other words, they lose their brain reflexes. And that person becomes lifeless. And this occurs within moments. And we define that as death. And that's always been the definition of death. Now, what we've come to understand is that obviously up till about 1960, that was essentially that point, and that's why we have this perception that there is a moment, there is a point. Now, at 1960, by chance, a number of physicians in the United States discovered what we now call CPR, which is that essentially after a person has just died, if you do chest compressions, you can artificially create a circulation again, and if you give them breaths, then you can sort of sustain them. And that led gradually to this understanding that we can actually go beyond the threshold of death for a short period of time, say 10 minutes or 20 minutes maximum, and then bring people back sometimes. And so the way that we use to bring someone back to life after they've died is understanding what those processes are that occur after death, manipulating those processes, and ensuring we can restart the heart and bring back a whole person without brain damage. And that is the sort of art and science of resuscitation science in the last 10 years.
Without brain damage?
The key thing is that there have been a number of very important discoveries in the last 10 years that, if put together and implemented, will ensure that we can prevent brain damage, or at least minimize it significantly in people that we can bring back. And this is one of the key discoveries from the medical side of what we do.
Tell the listener the extraordinary story of Joe Tirolosi, the New York taxi driver.
Well, if you look in the medical literature now, there are many people who have been brought back to life after prolonged periods that we thought was impossible. Joe Tirolosi is a patient that I personally took care of when I was at Cornell Medical Center in New York, at least for part of his stay. And he was somebody who was brought into the hospital and had resuscitation, in other words, CPR, for almost 50 minutes. Now, the key thing is that not only did he have this very prolonged CPR and resuscitation phase, but actually he came back without significant brain damage, even though this was quite prolonged. And the key thing that really helped him was that at that time, there had been a New York-wide process of implementation of cooling people who had just died. And it's important to understand that cooling is very important because when a person has no blood flow to the brain cells will start to die. But if you can cool them down, and I'm not talking about freezing, but just chilling them, so from 37 degrees to 32 degrees, you can slow down the rate by which the cells are undergoing death and therefore keep them in this sort of hibernation phase. And so he received that as well as a number of other important therapies. But having said that, as incredible as it was, and he, you know, was all over the newspapers, if you look in the medical literature, there are more profound cases, more incredible stories. And the longest case of a person who I've seen being published in the medical literature, which was in 2011 in the journal Resuscitation, was a case of a young Japanese woman who actually died in a forest, was not found for at least, it sounds like, 4 to 10 hours possibly. But was eventually found by a passerby, literally without any CPR now, I'm talking about nothing. Received CPR once an ambulance arrived all those hours later, and was taken to a hospital. Now, in Japan, they use a particular system, which is almost standard of care in their emergency rooms, where they have a machine called ECMO. It stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It literally is a device that takes blood out of a person's body, provides oxygen to it on a membrane on the outside, and then pumps it around the body. And so they kept her on this machine for up to 6 hours, and then eventually her heart started. And within 3 weeks, she left the hospital walking out. And I understand from her physicians that she had a baby in the last year. So this is really what we're talking about, which is absolutely completely profound.
I'm just, the silence is because it's quite mind-boggling. Still on the notion of the cooling process as a means to slow down cell damage and deterioration, tell us about a third case, that of Aaron Basson.
Well, this was an interesting case because, as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, I've been actively involved in resuscitation research for a number of years, and I work with hospitals across the UK where we study not only the brain in order to make sure we can bring people back safely, but also their consciousness and what happens to a person after they've gone beyond the threshold of death as part of the AWARE study. And one of our collaborating hospitals in London contacted me to say that they had this remarkable case of a patient that they had brought back to life. And he was in his 50s, had gone to, you know, have a drink. It was sort of in December, and didn't feel well, eventually made his way to the hospital, and then he died just as he arrived. Now, that particular hospital is incredible because they have kitted their emergency department with machines that can deliver chest compressions beyond what any human being can possibly do. So he arrives, they see that he died, they put him on the machine, and he had what we call technically an asystole, which basically means he was completely flatlined, which is generally thought to have almost no chance of survival. He was, however, put on this machine, and they continued CPR for 3.5 hours with the machine. And incredibly, they managed to get him back, which was completely astonishing, and it was all over the newspapers again. And he actually left the hospital a few days later, thanking everybody and walked out himself.
And once again, without significant brain damage.
Without significant brain damage, that's right. And that's remarkable because they had the machines, and also because it had been the winter, he himself had become relatively cold before his heart stopped. And therefore, the fact that his body was cool preserved his cells while he got excellent CPR and he came back.
Sam, I remember a very fine essay in New Yorker some years ago pointing out that there was no standardization at that time of anesthesia, of the machines that were used to deliver it, of the protocols, the knobs that turned left on one machine, turned right on another, and using the aviation industry as a symbol or as a metaphor. A couple of doctors worked very hard to achieve standardization, and once it was achieved, the mortality rate was vastly decreased. What is the dynamic at the moment? Because, of course, one of the problems in the area we're discussing is that not one medical area owns the idea.
You've raised a very important point, which is that, we have to go back a little bit in history. If you think about it, in the 1930s or 40s, medicine was not very advanced. And therefore, it was possible to ask a single doctor to be relatively knowledgeable about a fairly large area of work or body of work. But as medicines become super specialized, we find that it's impossible to ask any, and perhaps very good doctors, to be up to date with everything all the time. And cardiac arrest suffers from the fact that by virtue of being death, people can die under the care of any number of doctors under many different wards or areas of hospitals. And therefore, it's very difficult to ensure that all doctors with different areas of expertise, different strengths, different weaknesses, are fully up to date with all the advances that they need to know and to implement. And what you find is that most people, and this includes most physicians in all honesty's perception of cardiac arrest care, is literally still limited to what was the 1960s, i.e. just doing a series of chest compressions and providing a series of breaths and maybe giving some drugs and maybe giving the odd electrical shock if warranted. And that, to me, and the way I try to explain it in the book, is that really this is the most basic form. But it really is the 20th century form of resuscitation, and there have been enormous advances in the 21st century which need to be implemented.
Very often it's wartime, it's the military that seem to have driven quite a lot of progress in medicine, trying to keep soldiers alive on the battlefield. Has the Pentagon got interested in your work?
Well, I'm not fully aware of everything the Pentagon does, but I do know that the defense in the United States are obviously very interested in finding ways of minimizing brain injury in people who have had either traumatic brain injury because of gunshot wounds or who are getting what we call anoxic brain injury, in other words, a lack of oxygen when the heart stops and a person's just gone through death. So, yes, I think there is interest in that. But I think the problem that we really have, as you pointed out earlier, is that we need, for example, in the United States, we need the federal government to come in and set up standards of care that hospitals need to abide by and that they are obliged to report their survival, their practices, whether they deliver good quality, even basic chest compressions, how they deliver their breaths, as well as the more sophisticated care such as cooling, which unfortunately is not mandated, and therefore you have individual doctors making their own individual decisions, and having many chefs is never a good thing when you're trying to cook.
The science of medical resuscitation is one thing. The ethics is another. At what point would you not attempt to resuscitate?
In my opinion, if you look at all the advances that have occurred, it's important for us to put together all of these links together in order to save people who have a chance of having a meaningful life when we bring them back. And it's important to appreciate that cardiac arrest, by definition, is the only medical condition that every single one of us will go through. There's no doubt about it. I will have it, you will have it, and so will every single listener. And what we don't want is for our chance of coming back to be dependent on chance or our ability to come back but have or not have brain damage be down to potluck, which is the way it is today. So in my opinion, if we put everything together, then the decision needs to be made before a person has died. In other words, if someone has a medical condition that cannot be cured and treated, let's say they have cancer that unfortunately has spread enormously, for which there is no treatment available today in 2013, then when their heart stops, we shouldn't even do the most basic forms of chest compressions at all. We should just stop because there's no hope. We could not eliminate the problem that caused them to die. However, there are many of us who will die of things that are reversible. Let's say someone who has an infection and it just takes them away before the antibiotics would work, or they have a car accident, or they have a heart attack, or conditions that are essentially treatable by medical science today. Well, if we then implement all these higher standards of care, we can ensure that we can bring them back. So it's almost like we have to decide to give the right patients everything, and those of us who unfortunately, you know, cannot be cured of our ailments or have reached an age where we feel that we should be allowed to go, then I think we should respect that dignity and stop.
Ellen L. on RN Summer, and this is a chat with Dr. Sam Parnia about his book, The Lazarus Effect, and his extraordinary work on resuscitation. Now, let's go back to Joe Terolosi, because his case raised all the questions you'd been studying and was also the convergence of the two lines of investigation you're pursuing, resuscitation on the one hand and the fundamental mystery of human consciousness. Now, you interviewed Joe a few days after he awakened from the induced coma. What did he tell you?
Well, I actually found out about Joe Terolosi because the nurses who were taking care of him contacted me saying you must come and talk to him when he woke up in the coronary care unit when they took him out of his coma. Because they said he's had a profound experience and we don't feel equipped enough to talk to him about it. So when I spoke with him, it became very clear that he had indeed had a very profound experience. He described this enormous sense of relief, peace as he'd gone through his cardiac arrest, and that he'd met this being, a being of love that's full of compassion, that guided him through his experience. And this is not uncommon. A lot of people do describe a sensation of either seeing deceased relatives, almost who've come to welcome them, or seeing a being of light that guides them through. And sometimes they have an instantaneous panoramic review of their entire life. And what's fascinating is that many of them describe that they end up judging their own actions. So not only do they see what they do, but they actually feel what they did. So for instance, if someone had caused pain upon somebody else, even if it was by accident, it wasn't meant to be, they will still feel the discomfort that their actions had caused other people. So they themselves essentially judge. And then many of them, of course, go on to a place that they describe as being very beautiful, that they did not want to come back from. But for whatever reason and different reasons, they eventually come back.
Perhaps you weren't always doing them a favor with, with resuscitation. Okay, as I mentioned, I know three people who were dead for various lengths of time. None of them reported anything as amiable or pleasant as what you're describing, but I'm well aware that there are many, many hundreds of cases, and you've collected 500 yourself, of people who had what used to be called an NDE. You don't like the term. You think it's scientifically problematic.
If you look at the history of near-death experience, it's very interesting. You know, as I mentioned, we discovered the system of CPR in 1960, and the first book that was published on near-death experiences came out in 1975. And it described, in essence, the experiences that people had had who'd been critically ill and who'd been brought back to life again, some of whom had had a cardiac arrest and actually gone beyond the threshold of death. However, the term near-death is very, very problematic because it's enormously vague. If you're studying something in science, you have to be precise. And in medicine, we have no term, we have no such term as near death. I mean, you either die or you don't die or you're critically ill. And the conditions that make you be critically ill, whether it be meningitis, a gunshot wound, road traffic accident, different types of infections, heart attacks, cancer, whatever you may think of, their underlying biology is enormously different. And to clump everything together is highly problematic. And I think to a large extent, that is what has caused a lot of the controversy and the debate, because people have put together things that are very different under one umbrella, and then they fight and they debate about them. So it's important to appreciate that the people that we study are those who've gone objectively beyond the threshold of death. We understand the biology of death very precisely. We know that as soon as the heart stops, even when you do CPR, that there is no brain activity within 2 to 20 seconds. Everything goes completely flat. The brain flatlines, everything flatlines. We then also understand, you know, minute by minute, what happens to brain cells after a person has died, whether they receive CPR or whether they don't receive CPR. And so the biology becomes completely standardized. And that's why for those people who've gone beyond the threshold of death, I like to call their experiences an actual death experience.
Okay.
Because scientifically, we can now study them. We can compare them. We have no more fog. We have no more gray zone. So that's really that point. And if I may, I just want to address what you brought up earlier, right at the beginning of the conversation as well, about the people that you know who've had no experiences. Classically, we know that 10 to 20% of people who go beyond the threshold of death will come back with these incredible experiences, which are universal, have been described from all over the world, and they've been described in millions of people now. They're all over, from children less than 3 years old to any age that you can think of. The reason why the majority of people don't recall them is most likely because when a person's gone through death and we bring them back, the first thing that happens is their brain swells up enormously and it becomes enormously inflamed. And therefore, their memory circuits become completely wiped out. So it's a little bit like the fact that we all know, for instance, that we dream every night. But if you were to ask us, we don't remember the dreams. It doesn't mean we didn't have them. And so while, you know, the three people you mentioned said to you, oh, well, there was nothing there, no, there's no judgment, there's nothing, doesn't necessarily mean there was nothing. It's more likely that their memories were wiped out as a result of the effects after they came back.
I asked you at the outset about your religious views, but I accept the argument that we're describing or discussing something which seems to occur universally across cultures and religions. And I also read with interest that people generally describe the experience as being a transformative and positive one. Their lives are enhanced by the experience. As a result, they describe themselves as being more altruistic and less materialistic, less self-centered, less afraid of death. Okay. Talking about this decades ago, Susan Blackmore, whose work I'm sure you're familiar with, argued that what we might be dealing with is simply a process, effectively a mechanical shutdown, that these images, these sensations, might simply be the brain closing down.
Well, I think you've raised a number of very interesting issues there. First of all, I'm a big admirer of Susan Blackmore's work, we go back many years, actually. In order to really put this into perspective, it's important to realize, again, what Susan Blackmore was talking about was this vague entity of near death, where people could be at different levels of illness and different stages, which is not the same as people who've had a cardiac arrest and gone beyond the threshold of death. In essence, after near-death experiences were described, a number of people tried to fit it into a scientific model. So, for instance, Susan Blackmore suggested that this may be due to a lack of oxygen affecting the brain that may be causing an illusion, at least in terms of the tunnel effect and seeing the light. And others came through with other opinions. Most of us who are involved in the field today in the 21st century from different parts of the world agree that actually those explanations were appropriate at the time, but are not supported by the evidence that's come through over the last couple of decades. For instance, we know that there's no relationship between oxygen and having these experiences. People have them under different circumstances. And there have been, of course, thousands of studies of the effect of oxygen in people. As you pointed out, I'm a critical care doctor, and almost every night that I'm on call, I deal with many patients who have low oxygen levels. And we don't see them having anything that resembles a near-death experience. So I think the general consensus, at least with those who are actively involved in the field, not those who are looking out from the periphery, is that this is a universal experience that we cannot account for using models such as oxygen, carbon dioxide, drugs, because there is no supporting evidence for them.
Might it perhaps... And I'm putting on a Richard Dawkins cap, might it perhaps be an evolutionary development to make death less terrifying?
If I may, I'm going to focus on the patients who I study, which are those who've gone beyond the threshold of death, to explain this. It's, as I pointed out earlier, when a person has died, the brain shuts down within moments. And that's simply logical because there's no blood getting into the brain. When you then do CPR, even if you do great quality CPR, you cannot get enough blood into the brain to reactivate the circuits and generate any electrical activity. And we know that in order for the brain to communicate, you have to have electrical activity and communication between different parts of the brain, which become completely flat during the time of what we call a cardiac arrest, even with CPR. So at that time, there is no time for people to have any kind of psychological reaction. It's not like you have time to imagine you're about to die. This happens in an absolute instant. Your heart suddenly stops and you're gone. So it's very hard to imagine that this is something that's sort of evolving gradually. If you were looking at people perhaps in a hospice who are slowly dying, you might be able to put forward those kind of arguments. But there's very little evidence to suggest that. What we do know is that it appears that after a person has died, at least in the first period of death, in other words, the first few hours, that entity that we call consciousness, the thing that makes us aware, thinking beings, does not become annihilated. It simply hibernates. And we as the outsiders cannot see it. So to us, the person looks like they're completely unconscious. But actually, it does not become annihilated. And that's why we probably have reports of people who do claim to be able to see things, hear things, and accurately describe exactly what was happening in the rooms, conversations, clothing, etc.
This is the so-called out-of-the-body experience.
That's a term that's been used to describe this. Again, as far as I'm concerned, this is simply reports of awareness during resuscitation, which is what led to the AWARE study.
Well, in the time we've got left, can you talk to the AWARE study? AWARE is awareness during resuscitation.
You see, again, if we sort of take off, and this is one of the things I've tried to do in my work, is to demystify the concept of death and make it into a scientific entity and allow us to study it and understand it from that perspective. If you take away social perceptions and philosophical perceptions about death and just boil it down to science, when a person dies, as I said, brain activity ceases, but the cells inside the brain only start to undergo their own process of death at that time. Now, biologically speaking, there are parts of the brain that are involved with your conscious awareness, the fact that those of us who are talking or listening to the radio, we're fully awake and alert. That's because certain parts of in the middle of our brain have numerous chemicals that are at a particular balance that keeps us awake. For instance, if you take a strong antihistamine, especially the older generation, histamine itself is involved with putting you to sleep or keeping you awake, depending on the levels, as are various other chemicals. So when a person dies, and I'll just explain a bit more, if you have a general anesthetic, for instance, those chemicals work on those areas of the brain and they switch off your consciousness. If you get a severe illness like liver failure and you have chemicals building up in your system, those chemicals will affect those parts of your brain that keep you awake and alert, and they put you into a sleep, and if it's deeper, you go into a coma. So when a person dies, biologically speaking, all that's happened is you've stopped delivering oxygen to those parts of the brain that keep a person awake and alert, and as a consequence, they go into a deep coma, like would occur with any other condition. Now, obviously, as time progresses, those cells involved in the structure of the brain will eventually start to go through their own process of death and will eventually decay to a point where you cannot get the person back. But that's why I explained that at the beginning of death, the evidence is that consciousness is not annihilated. It's very similar to what happens when you're given a general anesthetic, when you appear to be completely unconscious or in a coma, but it hasn't disappeared into thin air. There's something still there, and I think that's why they can recall what's going on.
At the same time as looking at your book, I've been rereading Oliver Sacks' latest on hallucinations, and Oliver's an old friend of the program. And there are certain overlaps between what he's coming up with or what he's reporting on in terms of what might be called altered states of consciousness and your studies of the brain and consciousness. Have there been any results yet to the overarching AWARE study that you can reveal?
Well, I've had a lot of inquiries about the AWARE study through the years. It's a completely new study, new type of study, I should say, because we're trying to essentially study consciousness and awareness in people who should have no brain activity, which obviously makes it very difficult. And unfortunately, for various reasons that are out of my control, many of these patients are not brought back to life. And as I explained earlier, those who are brought back, the majority of them have their memories wiped out. So it's hard. So I've tried to summarize the results at least up till the end of 2012 in the book. And in essence, yes, we've had people who've had awareness, not as many as we had hoped because we've had fewer patients come back to life in order for us to interview them. And so the study, after 3 to 5 years of sort of going through a feasibility stage, we have taken on what we've learned and we're trying to adapt and change it and move on based upon the evidence that's been coming through.
Of course, Sigmund Freud had quite immense difficulties in trying to make sense out of dreams. It must be immensely difficult for you as a scientist to deal with ephemera like awareness experiences.
Well, consciousness itself is the biggest mystery probably in science. You know, what is it that makes us into who we are? Why am I a thinking, conscious being? Why do I seem to have the ability to make decisions for myself? And why do I have all types of emotions and rational thought and all the rest of it? Of course, this is not something that only we have been interested in. This goes back at least to the time of the great Greek philosophers, if not just before. And if you boil down, you know, in a very simplified way, the philosophical arguments that have now led on to science today, you find that there were two different sort of viewpoints. But in essence, what the Greeks referred to, and they called it the psyche, was what made a person who they were, their psychological functions, their morality, their ethics, their emotions, etc. And then the word psyche was later translated into the word soul into English. But at the time, the Greeks didn't necessarily believe that the psyche or the soul, or what we now call consciousness, was necessarily everlasting. Many of them, including Aristotle, believed that when you die, because the psyche, the soul, or consciousness is a product of bodily processes, when the body dies, that also dies. There were, however, others, such as Plato, who believed that actually psyche, soul, or consciousness is separate from the body and therefore continues to exist after we die.
Where do you stand on this, Sam?
I don't have any personal opinions because I've been thoroughly involved in this for so long. But what I can say is that for the first time, we are able to try to answer these questions through the objectivity of science. And if you look at the evidence that's coming through, it does suggest that we should at least consider the possibility that consciousness may continue when the brain does not function and the person's gone beyond the threshold of death, which, of course, if proven further, would support Plato's view rather than Aristotle's view.
Sam, thank you for this. Talking to Dr. Sam Panea, a critical care doctor and director of resuscitation research at the Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York. Sam's book, The Lazarus Effect, The Science That Is Erasing the Boundaries Between Life and Death, and it's published here in Australia by Random House. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you very much.